This is side two of broadcast number 624, November 21st, 1983. They were talking about the movie, the nuclear movie on television, and Mr. Pearl of the State Department was talking about that. And Evans and Novak, very conservative, were saying to him, do you blame the people who made the movie for, it was tantamount to treason going against Ronald Reagan's wishes. Who do you blame for this kind of broadcasting? And Pearl said, I blame the ABC broadcasting, because without them communicating the message, people wouldn't care about the movie. And that, in essence, is the tragedy that happens when somebody has information and has good information, how then they're blocked, you know, they're cornered, and you can't get it out. Now, Bernard Fensterwald, who's in the CIA, he's worked for the CIA, he's the attorney for people like Mitchell Werbel, and he's the attorney for James McCord, so I'm not saying anything against him. He wrote a book, and he described Gordon Novell, the fellow that is living in Larry Flint's home. He wrote about Clay Shaw and the Permandex Corporation a little bit, and then he described the Gordon Novell, the character of Gordon Novell. He said, Novell is a young electronics expert. He became involved in Jim Garrison's investigation, the charges of Clay Shaw and the murder of Kennedy, when he volunteered to provide information relating to Cuban exile activities. Garrison accused Novell of being a plant in his house at that time and announced he was investigating Novell's connections to David Ferry and the Central Intelligence Agency. Novell was subsequently involved with Watergate conspirator Charles Colson in the mysterious plan to erase some of President Nixon's secret Watergate tapes. In March 1967, District Attorney Garrison subpoenaed Novell to testify about the August 1961 munitions burglary in Louisiana, which was carried out by David Ferry and Sergio Ocasio Smith, a Cuban exile leader, and Gordon Novell on March 16, 1967. Before appearing before the grand jury, he told reporters he would testify about activities during 61 that related to Mr. Smith. But when Garrison wanted another subpoena to talk about those same people and the murder of John Kennedy, he disappeared. He showed up in Columbus, Ohio, and has never had to appear in a court to tell his relationship to the murder of John Kennedy. He wasn't interested in doing that. Novell seemingly was warning a former intelligence contact that Garrison was investigating Novell's connection to the Bay of Pigs. This is Clay Shaw, the trial of Clay Shaw, when David Ferry and Clay Shaw were involved. And as soon as Jim Garrison arrested Clay Shaw, David Ferry was murdered. And Bernard Fensterwald is writing about a letter written. It says, this letter is to inform you that District Attorney Jim Garrison has subpoenaed myself, an associate, to testify before the grand jury on matters which may be classified top secret. The actions involve dual individuals connected with Double Check Corporation in Miami in the first quarter of 61. Mr. Garrison is unaware of Double Check's involvement in the matter, but he has strong suspicions, and he would not go into the role of the Bay of Pigs invasion, the CIA, the Double Check, because they were later involved in the murder of John Kennedy. And he said he just wasn't going to show up. And there's a picture of him in Bernard Fensterwald's book on Gordon Novell. Then it says, Novell was finally compelled to return to New Orleans for questioning by the grand jury in April of 67. He made his first appearance in court the afternoon of April the 3rd to post bond for his arrest. He then hinted at a cover-up in the case and was suddenly interrupted by his lawyer while beginning to mention the name of a particular Cuban exile. The headline said, Witness in Plot Investigation Hints a Cuban Link. On the night following Gordon Novell's court debut, President Johnson's top aide, Marvin Watson, called J. Edgar Hoover's top aide, Carthy DeLoach, and informed him that President Johnson was now convinced that the CIA was involved in the Kennedy assassination. Novell was hinting, you know, if you put me on the stand, I'll let you know about the conspiracy. And, of course, then we never heard any more about it. I had an idea for this anniversary of Kennedy's death that we should go in front of Larry Flint's house and call a press conference and tell the press that there are two men inside that will tell them on the 20th anniversary who killed John Kennedy. And Don Fried wanted to do it with me, and I spoke to somebody at the L.A. Times. But then I was afraid that Larry Flint would be murdered if we pulled this. I didn't know that the great suicide trip was going to come off the next day. I don't want to be responsible any more than I have been for the mess that he's in. So I'm not going to be in front of his house. There's not going to be a press conference. And I think he belongs, if he's been drugged with the MK Ultra drugs, he belongs in a mental hospital. You can get a 72-hour hold on the basis that you protect a person from themselves. And this is obviously suicidal, and I called Mr. Barron's office today. He didn't call back to see if we can get some people, the doctors or the police, to hold him back, not drive him to any airport, because they're driving him to his death, and they're a part of the murder and the suicide. And the whole thing is that he should come off the MK Ultra and get treatment and go back to doing what he was doing before somebody planted the idea that he should kill himself, because it was never there until these house guests arrive. Now, in the book, Spooks, I just copied a few sections to share with you to give the essence of the house guest that is staying there, because this is Mr. Big of the entire United States. As a matter of fact, Jim Hogan's book called Spooks begins with Mitchell Werbel. The first 28 pages are on him because he's the most important spy in probably in the world now that Otto Skorzeny is dead, and he worked with Skorzeny, Hitler Skorzeny, when he was alive. And the book goes into Robert Mayhew and Mitchell Werbel, and he says, the archetype of the master spy, Bell is certifiably lethal with his hands, a master of Chinese knifing, a crack shot, a brilliant interrogator, a legendary inventor of spy tech. To add that, he's somewhat of a mystic. He works in ESP, and it goes into his mysticism. Werbel is like a man in love with death. He has spent his life courting it, a specialist in the development of assassination devices. He moves from one capital to another, arranging coup d'etats while flogging the most murderous devices that he can invent to fugitive millionaires and third world fascists alike. It's all legal, whatever its morality, and the weapons that filter down to the commandants of political death squads. Men whom Werbel admits he probably knows, it's none of his affair, so long as his papers are in order and his politics are right, he'll show up with these people. He has all kinds of dirty tricks, the lethal light bulbs, the telephone receivers, etc. That is Mr. Death. Would you like him for dinner tonight? And telling you, I will help you rent an airplane and you can go out over the ocean in that nice cold ocean, as if Larry McDonald were his hero, okay? Spook says the clients of such people like the Werbels are the financial establishment, the Hughes Organization, the Hunts, H.L. Hunt, the Rockefellers, the Gettys, the Fords, the Niacros, the Grahams, the Mellons, the ITT, the Exxons, the Chase Manhattan, Northrop Bell Telephone, American Express, Marriott Corporation, and one of the big investors into Mitchell Werbel's corporation is Stuart Mott. The image of the American left, okay, he has invested heavily into Nobel's company. The Virginia headquarters are Dektor Counterintelligence, and Colonel Bell tells the significance of his fighting wand and all of his other equipment. Mitchell Werbel doesn't wear cufflinks, Hogan says, but if he did, they'd probably contain explosives. The cane he carries conceals a small but serviceable sword. Larry Flint had to go to court last week, and Mitchell Werbel went with him, and he was arrested. Werbel had posted like $6,000, which is nothing, because he had a weapon in court. It was this great cane that he carries, his stick. He has a swagger stick that doubles as a rocket launcher. Our soup's on, Mr. Flint. Let's get our dinner. When he's on a business trip, his attaché case is neatly fitted with the tools of his trade, a featherweight submachine gun nestled in deep velvet beside a specially designed silencer. Together, they're capable of squeezing off 800 rounds of ammunition in a minute and almost perfectly preserved quiet. Werbel is a spook who specializes in the craft of assassinations and the freelance coup d'etat. He loves his work. You like that one? And then in the same paragraph, the same introduction, he talks about Bobby Hall, who worked with them, and he was the man who drugged Howard Hughes with Jack Eggers of the Beverly Hills Police, and their blackmailing operations for Howard Hughes and working with Robert Vesco and the CIA. and their calculated smears and surveillance and their spy operations. This is Mr. Spy who has moved into the house. He refers to Edward Bennett Williams, Robert Mayhew, Mitch Werbel, the spooks at Intertel and the Hughes organization. Their paths crisscross in what amounts to a plenum of P-L-E-N-U-M, plenum of secret agentry, going all over the world with headquarters in Georgia, a mansion in Costa Rica, suites in Houston, Atlantic City, and so forth. The map is filled with their presence. Werbel, with a huge handlebar mustache, is a paratrooper. He's depicted in battle dress as a paratrooper with his boots, Australian bush hat. He usually has his Ingram M10 submachine gun cradled in his arms as often as not as his silencer. I might say right here, because I may not have time later to include this, that when I went to Los Angeles to make a movie called The Howard Hughes Mystery, Manuel Zosima was from Nicaragua. He had a distribution company of films. His offices were on Robertson Drive in Beverly Hills. And the movie that we made was destroyed, The Howard Hughes Mystery. And Broderick Crawford was in it, and I played an investigator, and I had about six scenes. And then we filmed it again, and that was destroyed. And then Manuel Zosima was forced to leave the country, and I, from all I know, he hasn't been back seen. There was no Hughes movie. And then I met Terry Moore through him and helped write a book with her, ghost write a book with her, and worked there for a couple of weeks, came back to Carmel, went back to her house, and in her living room was a man sitting in a chair. Some of you know this story. And his wife is Marge. Her name is Marge. She did typing for Ronald Reagan. And the living room was an arsenal. It's the first time I ever sat around. I didn't sit with him. He sits there. They had a trailer. There was an armed camp at Terry Moore's house from a nice home, a nice lady, and her mother and her two kids, writing a biography about the Hughes organization. And Marge's husband is sitting there with rifles and all kinds of pistols or what have you. Well, she takes a scissors and cuts up what I wrote with Terry Moore. And that is the problem of getting out publications. If you say, why doesn't Mae Bressel write more? I'm game, but look what happens in the way of getting publications out. When I first met Paul Krasner, he was enthusiastic. He was brilliant. He was excited. He was full of piss and vinegar. He couldn't wait to get The Realist out. Why was Martha Mitchell kidnapped? He's living up in Watsonville. And he published three of my articles. The Senate Select Committee is part of the cover-up, and the SLA is the CIA. By the time he got the SLA article done, Krasner was like a vegetable. He was so full of whether it was peyote or LSD and marijuana and hashish that his mind was scrambled for a long, long time. He's doing stand-up comedy now. He's been writing his autobiography for years. He virtually just went into seclusion for a long, long time. He worked for Larry Flynt for a while. Flynt set up headquarters for his other article on the John Kennedy assassination. And 1 month after it was published, Larry Flynt was shot with three bullets and was left permanently paralyzed and is in a wheelchair. And so he recovered. He had about 5 years of recovery. He's living in constant pain and finally had some laser surgery this last year. The pain went away. So he decided he'd make his splash into the world and come out with The Rebel. And the same week before The Rebel comes out, the agency moves into his home, and he is like a virtual prisoner inside of his home, prepared to die. This is the American tragedy. When I tell it to you on the air, it seems so unreal that I can almost say it without breaking down. All week, it was the hardest week I ever had. I was so perplexed about the idea of those people there, that here he's telling the story of the Nazis, and these men worked with the Nazis, worked with Galen's men in the operation. They know from A to Z who killed Kennedy, and here is the only publisher in America who has the nerve to print who killed John Kennedy in that article, and the network of the cover-up and the agents involved who should be brought in. And in his home, simultaneously, are those people that can endanger his life, but rather than take it, get him to take it himself on some flimsy excuses. Also, something was accomplished this week that Larry Flynt did once before, and when I met him, he was aware of the role of Dick Gregory and Mark Lane in covering up his experiences when he went to Georgia, that Robert Byron Watson knew that Larry McDonald and that group were Murder Incorporated, that Lane knew it and Gregory knew it, and they didn't tell him, and he went to Georgia and was shot. And all of a sudden, Dick Gregory is at the home of Larry Flynt eating dinner with Gordon Novell and Mitchell Werbel. He is the black Idi Amin that has the Adolf Hitler pictures with Frank Turpel, the man in Africa who is the par excellence fascist. Now, you may think what you want, and I've never discussed publicly much about Gregory, except you know that I have no use for... last time I saw Gregory was at my home a couple years ago when I said, why didn't you put in the thing about Larry McDonald and Larry Flynt in your book, Codename Zorro? Because this fellow was in a gallery a week before Martin Luther King was killed and talked about it. And you could check out all those allegations and ask the courts of the House Select Committee to do something about it. He's been on the side of the fascists, dancing around with them for so long. He didn't have to eat dinner with them. He absolutely didn't have to. Don Freed was in New York for a month. His play on Richard Nixon was off Broadway. He flew back. He walked into Larry Flynt's house. Down the steps comes Mitchell Werbel, who you would know instantly. And he says, Mitch Werbel? And he says, yeah. And Mitch calls Novell, Gordon, come here. And to his credit, Don Freed turned around and went out of the door. You don't have to dine. Robinson Jeffers wrote a poem that... Corruption is not compulsory, and he walked away from it. We have choices. You don't think you have choices in life, you have choices. Dick Gregory is going to be in New York at some holistic fair where he talks about his dieting and his great health care and his jogging and so forth, and there's a lot of people, you know, fighting the nuclear weapon, and it's Paul Krasner's going to be there doing stand-up comedy, and all the world's a stage. So this person was telling me they were going to see Dick Gregory there. I said, yeah, you get up in the crowd and ask Gregory how he sits down for dinner with Mitchell Werbel and Gordon Novell. Explain that to the people, if you're so, enthusiastic to influence the young people on what's healthy. Why don't you sit down? Why don't you ask those men who killed Martin Luther King once and for all, or John Kennedy, and get on with it? Now, these same people have a lot of influence on him. And just a month before Larry Flynt was shot, he ran an ad in the various papers, New York Times, and in his L.A. Free Press that he bought. And he offered $1 million reward to anybody who found the killer of John Kennedy. And he said, I believe there are many untapped witnesses to the events of the assassination, and he wanted information. I'm personally guaranteeing $1 million reward for an explanation and a conviction of who killed John Kennedy. If you have any personal information, please contact us. I guarantee I will protect every bit of evidence that we gather. I guarantee. A month later, he's shot. No detail is too small to aid in the public campaign to solve the murder. He says, you get in touch with me or an independent panel you can call collect to Ralph David Abernathy, who never did a thing to help the House Select Committee find Martin's killers. Mark Lane, you're supposed to give him the information. Or Dick Gregory. This is in 1978. Dick Gregory and Lane hadn't even told poor Larry a month before or simultaneously what was in Georgia. Lillian Smith and Robert Groden, and we'll determine the appropriate recipient, signed Larry Flynt. That was in 1978, and 1 month later, he was shot and left paralyzed. Well, last week, on November the 18th, Larry Flynt runs the same article. Now, keep in mind that this was 1978, and he says, you tell me what witnesses you have, and we'll investigate the murders of John and Martin Luther King and so forth. December the 8th, 1978, Nicholas Harrock has an article in the New York Times that I've had on the air before. Memo discusses smuggling witnesses into Guyana. A memorandum found in the files of Reverend Jim Jones, apparently written by the People's Temple in San Francisco, discussed the possibility of using their lawyer, Mark Lane, to smuggle a witness in the Martin Luther King assassination down to Guyana using a false passport. Many of you know this story, and many of you don't. They had a woman who died in a car accident, and they were going to take Grace Walden, a witness to the fact that James Earl Ray was not in the rooming house the day that Martin Luther King was shot. She saw somebody else. And the House Select Committee was investigating that murder, and she was in a mental hospital in Tennessee. And when the House Select Committee began investigating Martin Luther King's murder, Mark Lane was given custody of her as if she was something to rent out, like an Avis rent out this witness. She was supposed to use the passport of Maxine Swaney, S-W-A-N-E-Y, who had died, and they were similar in appearance, and Grace Walden would use her passport. They said there's one drawback, that if any traitor talked about it, they would be in trouble. Now, they were going to use this transference of a primary witness out of the country to Jonestown, where by June 78, they were just practicing decapitation of children, telling them how to, they were going to be decapitated. And they were brought in three pigs, and they gave them cyanide to show that cyanide was kinder, because in November they were going to be dead. November 78, they were going to be dead in Jonestown. And in early 78, in May of 78, when this came out, simultaneously, they're running an ad, tell us your witnesses. Tell us who you know. How many witnesses would you need that would be sent to mental hospitals or down to places, which I suspect the 180 people in the mental hospital in Grenada that it was used for that kind of activity, and the secret there was bombing them out so that they wouldn't be identified, like the people in Jonestown couldn't be identified. So we're going to 1978, where Mark Lane's name is mentioned in using a primary witness to something that he's been supposed to investigate for a few years since Martin Luther King was killed in 1968. And 10 years later, they're shipping a primary witness when Congress has an investigation. The day he was supposed to testify, he ran out of the room and left and didn't have Grace Stevens testify, and he went down to Guyana because Leo Ryan was going to get into Jonestown, and he had to get there first and tell Jim Jones about it and then sit out in the orchard while 912 people died with Charles Gary. Now, in 1978, when all this was going on with Jim Jones and Mark Lane, and in June 68, they were telling the kids they were going to have to die, and they gave them different colored choices of the cyanide and rehearsing the decapitation or the poison choice, Dr. Shock bringing in three pigs and showing how fast and easy you die with cyanide just a little while before. You're supposed to send your information to Mark Lane and Dick Gregory, and absolute immunity. So what happens in November 18th, 1983? A full-page ad, Larry Flint, spends around $20,000 last week and runs it in the New York Times. Bring me, like the Statue of Liberty, bring me your tired and your poor. Once again, reward. Tell us who killed John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and John Paisley. The same Bernard Fensterwald of the CIA that represents John McCloy and Mitchell Werbel also represents Marianne Paisley. And he says, I will grant you immunity, the same immunity you got then. And look at the danger. I hope I make this clear, the implication. Dick Gregory, Mitchell Werbel, and Gordon Novell at the dining room of Larry Flint, and they're placing an ad saying, tell us who you know was involved in these murders. Now, in 1978, when this happened, I was horrified, knowing the track record of those two guys, okay? Lane and Gregory and Groden, the whole story. And I was disgusted because I called it then a vacuum clinger action. And maybe some of you have those tapes and we can go back and play it. I said, Larry Flint is running an ad, and you're going to put information in there. Then the remaining witnesses can be offed with automobile accidents, poison, go to mental hospitals. You're sucking in people who know something, and you can wipe them out very nicely, and nobody will know why they die. You simply turn their pocket inside out, and every murder is a robbery. You put a joint in their pocket, and it's a drug arrest, or a little white powder. I mean, buy a little powdered sugar and spread it around. You drop the powder, and you say it's cocaine. Or you put their pocket, or take the purse and snatch it, and take the coins, and obviously it was a murder for money case closed. The coroner says it's closed. Now, this is the horrendous thing. If you can visualize these men sitting in the home at a time, and I don't know when they're going out. Will they go out if he dumps into the ocean? Will they take over the home? It's, you know, the $5 million home in Bel Air. Is it theirs? The oil paintings, the chandeliers? Is this going to be the headquarters for the CIA in the future? How do you get them out when they're the government and the government steps in? I can't make it any more clear. It is a tragedy. It is something I've seen in its many forms for 20 years. There are a lot of movies I could have seen during the year. There are a lot of things I could have attended or parties. There were a lot of different activities where you take time off and just lay back. And I felt there was an urgency to the now. 20 years ago, 15 years ago, the now is here, just like that quote I mentioned about the artist. Then is now. What happened when those people took over the government is escalating right now. The total onslaught, the takeover of Central America, of every country. And then next it'll be the North Pacific, and then it'll be to surround Russia and go into Poland and begin that lovely little war that they've been wanting for so long. Kennedy was killed by the Pentagon, by the Defense Department, by the Fourth Reich. And people like Herman Abst are alive today. They're still doing their business. They're right in the Vatican. Incidentally, I don't know if many of you saw it. It wasn't in the news, except I saw it in the San Jose Mercury and the San Francisco Chronicle, not the Eastern papers, the Popessa, the woman that took care of Cardinal Pacelli and nursed him when he was sick and depressed when he lived in Germany, and then he went on to become the Pope, Pius XII. She describes in her biography, her autobiography, just before she died. She died just last week. She described her experience being there when the cardinal gave young Adolf Hitler money and began to fund him for the Anschluss that took place then a few years later, and she describes that scene where the money is handed over to young Adolf. Now, she died and left some things out of her book that she didn't want in her book until she passed away for secrecy reasons. And one of the things was that she housed with the Vatican the children of the Romanovs, that they lived, and that the story that the Romanov children died was a lie, that the Vatican protected them, and the anti-Russian propaganda went on. I once heard that, read several places, that in exchange for the Romanov family surviving, Lenin was allowed to go from Switzerland, you know, that book about the sealed train, to the Soviet Union and become head of the Soviet Union if the story of the Tsar held tight, that they had died. He could go back and run the government so that the Tsar family could live. And just this last week, there were stories that, in fact, the Vatican took care of them. Well, American history is now. Just a few more words. We've got about 1 minute. No, we don't even have a minute to talk about Mitchell Werbel. If you're interested in him, there's 40, 60, 80 pages. The book called Spooks by Jim Hogan. It's a paperback, or you can get it at your library. This is an American tragedy. This is one more shock to me. This is a real shock. I think it's probably one of the hardest weeks I've ever had in the research that I've done. We've had the accident in the family when Bonnie was killed and Marvin got his LSD from the Gilmans, from the CIA, when I was in New Orleans with Jim Garrison. I said to Larry Flint today, I said, look, my own son got LSD and wanted to kill himself several times, and that's what they've given you. And we'll get you the same doctors. You can get the same care. So if I get Larry Flint in a mental hospital this week, and if they kill him there, I'm responsible. He doesn't get in. He's a dead duck. And that is the sad part of this thing. I can't see a way to survive. And we'll see what brings next week. This is the anniversary of Kennedy's death. And this is a real American tragedy. This is Freedom of the Press, American style. And this is Mae Brussel on KAZU-FM in Pacific Grove, California.